Centennial Leasing, or council present on both sides of that case? If so, please approach, and when the tables vacate, take positions. His next case is Alicia Larson versus James Macaluso et al. Both council present in that case?
Yes, Your Honor.
Both of you are? Okay. Okay, good. Thank you. Let me repeat my very short record. These arguments have been set for 15 minutes per side. There is a timing system for keeping track of that time, which is manifested by a box on the lectern, which will give you green light during the first 10 minutes, a yellow light the next five, and a red light when the argument is over. And there is a digital countdown from 15 minutes to zero, so the appellant can keep track of time if you want rebuttal time. However, if you want me to help you with that, I'd be happy to, if you let me know how much you want to reserve. Having told you that the time you have is limited, I would advise you that we have read the briefs. We have read some of the authority cited in the briefs. We think we understand the case as submitted on the briefs. Particularly, we understand the facts. You may use the time any way you please, but we would recommend you go directly to your legal arguments and not dwell at it to any significant extent of your time on the facts. There's a microphone on the lectern, the purpose of which is to not only amplify the sound in the room, but to record the argument. The arguments are placed on the internet within a day or two of the argument. We would like you to stay near the lectern so we can clearly record your argument. We sometimes use it in the preparation of opinions. And it's much easier if we can understand you. There are also toggle switches on your right at the lectern to adjust it for height. If you find it uncomfortably high or low, please feel free to adjust it. We would ask, the crowd has thinned a little since our 9 o'clock session started, but we would ask anyone in the room who has a cell phone, a BlackBerry, an iPhone, pager, or any other thing that goes off with some surprise, to turn it off, put it on silent, and not respond to it until you've left the room if you must respond, so as not to disturb either the court or the counsel in the course of the argument. Are there any questions? If not, we're ready.
No questions, Your Honor. However, there's one point perhaps we should address before we go on the clock. And that is that I was not aware of the on panels. We arrived this morning. I couldn't find that button on the internet the other day. So I've not had a chance to discuss with my closing counsel. I would like to know for the record that you and I are both members of the Denver Rotary Club. I do not know you particularly well. We've spoken maybe once or twice. I don't believe there may be reason to be a conflict or conserve that.
It is a large but shrinking club. Okay, thank you. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. This case comes to court on appeal from the District Court for the City and County of Denver. We respectfully submit that the order of the District Court granting summary judgment in this case was erroneous and should be reversed. There are three issues on appeal. I'd like to take those issues in the order presented in the briefs, if I may. First question on appeal is whether the Certificate of Title Act, which is codified at CRS 42, Section 42-6-101 at SEC, barred the transaction at issue in this case. We would submit that it did not, and for the simple reason that the Certificate of Title Act does not govern the rights of the parties to a private commercial transaction such as that at issue in this case. Indeed, just, I guess it's been now 7 years ago, in the 2002 case of Satchin v. I believe American Family Insurance, the Colorado Supreme Court stated that it was, and I quote, well established that the provisions of the Act, once again, I direct the quote, do not govern the respective rights of the parties to a sale. The other cases, previous cases of both the Supreme Court and of this court, making that point well established by the time it reached the Supreme Court in 2002, are cited in our brief. Indeed, I would note that this court has specifically ruled that alleged noncompliance with the act is not a defense to an action for damages.
Counsel, my understanding of the act and the practical application of the act is that dealers who are bonded have virtual control over these things. I mean, they can give affidavits to correct problems with titles. I purchased a car that was sold at auction back in Illinois. I got an Illinois title. Not ultimately, but the paperwork I got showed an Illinois title. And I don't recall for sure whether the dealer's name was on that title or not, but it had been through an auction house when the seller doesn't know who's going to buy it. Is there any problem with an open title under the, as a practical matter, under the Certificate of Title Act when a dealer holds an open title?
There is not, and as a matter of fact, I believe you are correct that it is common for these things to happen and then corrections to be made later, especially when vehicles move through an auction. And I believe that's what happened in this case. In fact, when the auction is when the consignor, the seller of the vehicle, in other words, takes the auction and leaves it there, they don't know who's going to buy it, so obviously they can't fill out the title at that point. And we would submit there is no problem with this type of thing happening, and in fact, it'd either be a problem with if the reverse ruling were to hold. In other words, that the title were to have to be filled out in advance, basically in advance of the sale, or right at the moment of the sale, because that's not feasible typically with the way an auction is run. There is a case holding, cited in the briefs, that when a title is supplied with a, in blank is the term, that the immediate transferee only has authority to fill his or her own name in and then take it to the authorities for the issuance of a new title. And that's only one way that the problem can be handled. The problem can also be handled by, you know, the dealer can, or the buyer of the car can go back to the dealer and say, look, my title's not complete. Will you fill it out? Or will you finish it? And no doubt that would happen. In fact, that sounds like that may be what happened in your case. Certainly there are many ways that if the act comply, I guess the first question is, does the act comply? Or does the act apply to the rights of the parties to a private commercial transaction? We submit that it does not for the reason stated in the cases that we cited in our brief. The second question would be what you have, brought up, which is that if the act does apply, how can it be complied with? And there are many ways to do that, certainly. And many ways it could have been done, could have been carried out in this case, if the transaction had actually gotten to the point where title was to be transferred. However, we never reached that point because the buyer of the car, Centennial Leasing Sales, reneged on the deal first, and you know, nothing obviously happened after that point. We would submit there's no problem with the way that transactions are carried out, including the way the transaction is carried out in this case. Like we said, first of all, you know, it's established that the act does not apply. Period. As a rule of law, the act does not apply to the rights of a party to a private commercial transaction. And we would submit that this case is on all fours with the case of Randall v. Carroll, decided by this court in 1971, I believe. And indeed, that the court cannot rule for Centennial Leasing and Sales without, disagreeing with that case. I do not see any way that case can be distinguished on facts.
The other basis seem to be two other bases. One, that it was rescinded, that the contract was rescinded, and two, that because of discovery violations, the granting of the motion was appropriate.
Yeah, there was no ruling. Rescission was not an issue on summary judgment. There is a dispute between the parties as to what happened after the vehicle was delivered from AutoSource to Centennial, so Centennial could show it to its customer, Centennial's representative alleged that he made statements to Autosource that I suppose could be construed to support a rescission defense. That's obviously a question of fact and hasn't come to trial. Because Autosource's side of that, as set forth in their discovery responses and elsewhere, is that there was nothing of the nature. I mean, there was never any agreement to take the vehicle back. What the Centennial representative informed Autosource was, the guy wants the vehicle. Prepare the paperwork, and then the weekend it intervened, and apparently their customer decided he didn't want anymore, had buyer's remorse, and having already made the deal, Centennial tried to back out of it. Autosource never agreed to do that. I mean, never agreed to the rescission of the deal. And there's no evidence in the record that would support that, I don't believe. Certainly not something that would rise the standard sufficient to support summary judgment, which, of course, is there being no genuine question of material fact.
Counsel, sorry to interrupt. I just had a curious question. Your client did ultimately sell the car to somebody else, isn't that correct?
They did ultimately sell the car to somebody else in order to mitigate damages. As you may be aware, used cars sitting on auto lots depreciate. And in order to, my clients initially held that car for many months and withheld it from sale, informed the people who came to their lot that if they wanted to, and saw the car, saw it sitting there, that if they wanted to buy it, they'd have to talk to Centennial. They ultimately sold it to mitigate damages, and I would note that in their answer in this case, Centennial actually raised as an affirmative defense failure to mitigate damages, and I believe that's the nature of the defense, is that they allege we waited too long and therefore allowed the car to depreciate. So I would submit that summary judgment was clearly not supported on the grounds of rescission. Finally, with regard to the issue of alleged discovery violations, I guess the first thing to do right off coming out of the box is to admit that, yes, we were under the gun at that point. There were some errors of form made, and I'm not going to deny that. At the same time, I think it is clear that this issue does not support or justify dispositive sanctions in any way, shape, or form in this case. First of all, these discovery responses were served, and there is a signed certificate of service to that effect. Service is complete upon mailing, even if the document is not received. Second of all, even if one assumes that they weren't served until, several days later, look at the facts here. Centennial Leasing and Sales not only wasn't prejudiced here, they actually attached a copy of the discovery responses to their motion for summary judgment. And they said, look here, Judge, we've been so prejudiced by this alleged delay that we need to have dispositive sanctions.
Was there a trial date set at the time you filed your motion to withdraw the admissions?
I don't recall if there was a trial date set. However, if there was, it was not for quite a while. I mean, we were well in advance of the trial. I believe we had just set the trial date. We just set it a week or two before that. So, and this was in the late summer, early autumn. I think trial was set for the following April or something like that. And it was way out. I would submit that the court needs to look no further than the case of Sanchez v. Mooseburger to resolve this issue. That's a 2008 case of this court, I believe, in which the court ruled that it was an abuse of discretion not to grant a motion to withdraw alleged admissions, and reverse the judgment of the district court in that case. In that case, the court applied essentially a two-part test. First, whether the presentation of the merits would be promoted by allowing the amendment withdrawal or late response, and second, whether the party that obtained the alleged admission would be prejudiced in maintaining or defending his case. The court ruled that with regard to the first prong, which is whether the merits would be preserved, Clearly, the court said that where the trial court grants summary judgment based in whole or in part upon deemed, alleged deemed admission, disposing of the plaintiff's complaint, that part of the test is satisfied. And I don't think there can be any reasonable dispute to that question. The second issue is whether the party that obtained the alleged deemed admission would be somehow prejudiced. And the court noted that for issues such as a late arising need to obtain evidence to replace what they thought they already had would satisfy that. Certainly that wasn't present in this case. It wasn't even alleged in the motion by Centennial, but more importantly, we were very early in the case. We had just had our setting. Trial wasn't for many months, and there was no way, shape, or form in which Centennial would have been prejudiced. The mere fact they had to litigate the case rather than being granted an unmerited summary judgment, we would submit is not prejudice. And some I would say, once again, this case, if the decision of this court was correct in Sanchez v. Mooseberger, then this case almost answers itself because the facts are much stronger in favor of my client's position. In the Sanchez case, there had been a delay of, I believe, a month or 6 weeks in responding to discovery responses, and then a motion for summary judgment was filed based on those. In this case, take a look at the record. The defendants, Centennial Leasing and Sales, actually attached the discovery responses to their complaint, to their motion for summary judgment. They were prejudiced in no way, shape, or form. In fact, it seems pretty clear that their strategy was to attempt to use this issue as a way to advance the ball, not merely to and gain an unmerited judgment, not merely as a way to avoid prejudice. I guess at that point, if there are no questions, I would like to reserve my remaining time, which is...
You have just under a minute and a half.
Yes, I see it.
Yeah, good morning. Jared Walters on behalf of Centennial, who's the appellee here. Your Honor, Centennial really believes that the issue of the application of the Certificate of Title Act is a threshold issue, and that we need not advance to the second issue, which is before the court, and that is the issue of whether or not the trial court erred in deeming certain facts admitted as a discovery violation. I would ask that the court look primarily at page 143 of the record. That is the Illinois out-of-state title, and there are signatures contained on that page 143 of the record on that Illinois certificate of title. When you take a look at that, you'll notice a couple facts. One is that title is an out-of-state title. That's an important fact to consider. It's an out-of-state title versus a Colorado title. Second, you'll notice on that page 143 that there is an assignment to a company called R&R Motors. That is the second reassignment of the title. Below a signature of R&R Motors, there's a space for signature of buyer or agent, and that is blank on page 143 of the record. There's another important fact that I'd like the court to consider, and that's the fact that we are not dealing with a private party transaction between Jane and John Doe. Both of these parties, as you mentioned, Your Honor, are regulated and they're bonded entities, and they are regulated in a different manner than a private transaction would be regulated.
Well, this is a commercial transaction.
It is a commercial transaction, but it is also a transaction which is regulated because it's between two dealers rather than a dealer and a member of the general public purchasing it or a member of the general public selling to a dealer. Both parties are dealers. The fact that AutoSource is a dealer subjected AutoSource to different regulations than they would have otherwise been subjected.
Are you suggesting that there was no way that R&amp;R, that AutoSource could not provide documentation satisfactory to the title authorities in Colorado to transfer this car.
That's correct. And I refer you to 1 CCR 204-14. And that regulation.
Say that again, 1 CCR.
1 CCR 204-14. And specifically, Your Honor, Section 2 of that regulation requires that a motor vehicle dealer, and only a motor vehicle dealer, must have title assigned to the dealership. And that's a direct quote from that regulation.
And they can write their own name in, they can file an affidavit to correct it, can they not?
They cannot, according to that regulation, file an affidavit to correct it. The title must be signed, and Section 2 of that regulation requires that the dealer hold title in its name at the time the vehicle is offered for sale. That did not occur here. When you look back at that title document, page 143 of the record, there is no signature and there is no assignment. It's what's called an open title. Dealerships are forbidden from offering for sale a vehicle with an out-of-state title on an open title basis.
You said it's a regulated transaction. Who regulates it?
It's the Department of Revenue.
And have they taken any action in this matter?
AutoSource did, I believe, refer this matter to the Department of Revenue.
This is outside the record. I'm really asking what's in the record.
Okay. No, there was no action taken against either party by the Department of Revenue.
But the Department of Revenue has the authority, I take it, to take action against AutoSource if it believed that there was an unlawful offer?
Yes. And in fact, and I don't remember if the record reflects this or not, it may. This matter was before the Department of Revenue at one time on a complaint filed by AutoSource against Centennial. And it, nothing ever came of that complaint.
Whatever happened, isn't that the remedy if there's a violation of this particular rule to go to the auto board rather than taking it into court and arguing about whether or not it was a lawful offer?
Well, the fact that's important here on appeal is the fact that it was an illegal transaction because of the specific prohibition against AutoSource offering a vehicle with an out-of-state title where that title had not been transferred.
I understand that, but, and you're saying therefore it is per se void and cannot be enforced.
It's absolutely prohibited to offer that vehicle for sale.
That's not my question.
Okay.
Does that mean that it can't be enforced in a private transaction between two parties?
In a private transaction between a dealership seller that we have here, it cannot be enforced.
What cannot be enforced?
Any contract to purchase where the underlying agreement was based on a seller not having title to the vehicle.
And the authority for that is?
It's that regulation 1CC.
Are there any cases interpreting that?
No.
Are there any cases which hold that an offer that's made in violation of the Department of Revenue rules results in a void contract?
No. Along those same lines, the language of this 1 CCR 20414 I liken to a criminal statute in the fact that it's prohibited transaction. I liken this transaction to one where parties agree to buy or sell drugs or arms. Colorado law specifically prohibits the sale of drugs or illegal arms. What AutoSource is arguing here is that contract in and of itself is not an illegal or an impossible or an illegal contract or one that is impossible of performance. What they're arguing is we could have simply filled in our name at some point on this title and then offered it for sale. That's correct, but at the time they offered it for sale, they were in violation of that law.
Oh, no, wait a minute. You just said something very important. They could write their name on that title and complete the transaction.
But they can't offer it for sale.
They can put their name on the title and deliver to you Colorado Title. Is that right? And you said to me just a minute ago, there was no way they could get a Colorado Title based on that Illinois title. Now, I'm going to ask you again. They can fill in their name on that Illinois title and get you a Colorado title.
They can fill in their name prior to the time that they offer the vehicle for sale.
The question is whether they can. Your defense is impossibility.
Yes.
Okay. You're now saying they can deliver to you, they could have delivered to you at the time in question, title. The transaction is not impossible. It may violate a rule, but it's not impossible for them to deliver to you a marketable title in that vehicle by just putting their own name on that title.
That, if that's the way that came out from me, then I apologize for misspeaking. The question here is whether or not they could offer the vehicle for sale.
Your defense is impossibility.
Right.
Your defense is impossibility, which means they could not have performed the contract.
And they can't have performed a contract where they couldn't have offered the goods for sale.
Oh, that's not true at all. I can offer to sell you his car. And all I have to do is produce his car at the time of closing. Now, I may have to pay him a lot of money for that car because I've got a contract to sell it to you, but I don't have any right to sell that car to you.
You as a judge on the Court of Appeals, may offer that car for sale. Put yourself in the shoes of a motor vehicle dealer in Colorado, and you cannot offer that vehicle for sale. And that is,
I can't cover it on my transaction?
You can't cover it on your transaction?
No, I have a right to cover. I have a right to perform.
Not when you can't have offered it for sale. That goes back to the illegality and the impossibility of the performance. This transaction never could have gotten to the point of cover because AutoSource could not and was prevented from offering the vehicle for sale.
Okay.
As far as AutoSource argues that the Certificate of Title Act does not apply to a transaction as between two private parties, two dealership parties, I think the case law that has been cited by both parties is indicative of the fact that the Certificate of Title Act does in fact apply to every transaction to buy and sell a vehicle. And that is indicated by language, the language describing the purpose of the Certificate of Title Act. Counsel for AutoSource cited the Sachin case at 49 P3rd 1146. That is a Supreme Court case from 2002. That says, and I quote directly from that case, the purpose of the Certificate of Title Act is to ensure that purchasers of automobiles, whether individual citizens or dealers, can readily ascertain the status of the seller's title without recourse to other official state records, end quote. That gets us back into the purpose of this 1 CCR 20414. When the title doesn't indicate the owner or the transferee's name, we don't know who the titled owner is. In this case, how would AutoSource have known that how would Centennial, my client, have known that AutoSource wasn't brokering a deal for R&R Motors, whose name is indicated on the title, but AutoSource's is not? How would Centennial know that by holding this title on an open title basis, that AutoSource wasn't attempting to avoid some tax consequence of a sale?
What difference does it make to Centennial if Centennial gets title?
Well, if Centennial gets title, great. We don't know that we can get title when we don't know who owns the vehicle at that time. When you look at the When you look at that title that's at 143 in the record, all that I know is that R&R Motors is the owner of the vehicle.
Let's assume for purposes of argument only that Centennial or that AutoSource could deliver to you at a marketable title. Colorado would issue a title. Okay? So
okay.
You can sell it to your customer.
Okay.
Now, let's assume something comes up that there's something wrong with that title. Then what happens?
If there's something wrong with that title, then you'd go back to the dealer that sold it to you, in this case, AutoSource, and you would ask them to correct that title.
Okay. How many times has this happened in your experience, that a Colorado title issued by the Department of Revenue was challenged?
That a Colorado title, it happens fairly frequently that issues of title come up. I'm not sure, are you talking about defects on the face of the title?
I understand when the Department of Motor Vehicle issues a title, I have title. Now, it may not be perfect title. I don't know, somebody up the chain may be able to challenge that title, but can they challenge it and get the car from me, or do they have to go to the people who violated the law and created a bad title? Is there a remedy against me, or is it against the people in between the person who sold it to me and the actual owner?
The case of Cotting versus Jackson, which is a Colorado Supreme Court case from 1955, addresses that issue absent this regulation 1 CCR 204.14, and that is a case actually where the Supreme Court ruled that a party in the position of my client, who would have been an innocent purchaser for value, is approached later on down the road by the original owner of the vehicle. There was no chain of title between the innocent purchaser for value and its direct seller. The Supreme Court held that certificate of title ruled in that case, took the vehicle from the innocent purchaser for value.
Because there was no title transfer from his immediate purchaser.
Correct.
His immediate seller.
Correct.
We sort of on notice of that, isn't he?
Yes.
As opposed to not being on notice of it.
Correct.
I think we're out of time.
Thank you,
counsel. We thank both counsel for their arguments and briefs. Whoop! I'm about to cut you out of a minute and 20 seconds.
But I did have a brief question. I'd like to make one or two points by minute.
You may. You have a minute and 20 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. It appears my counterpart has focused exclusively on the regulation, specifically CCR 204-14. Therefore, I will limit my comments to the same issue. First of all, I think it's well established that regulations need to be interpreted in a manner that's consistent with their authorizing statute, or at least not in a manner that's contrary to the authorizing statute. In this case, the Certificate of Title Act, as interpreted in many cases by both this court and the Supreme Court, first has been held to not apply to a private commercial transaction, and second of all, has also been stated that it does not apply to the sales of vehicles, and those cases are cited in our brief. So we would submit that, first of all, the regulation must be consistently with those statutes. Second of all, I'd like to note that in the regulation cited by my colleague, there is not one word actually saying that a vehicle cannot be sold or a sale must be unwound. Rather, this is a regulatory action or regulatory provision which the Division of Department of Revenue can enforce against dealers, and which they didn't do in this case. There's sort of no violation alleged and no action taken, as I believe one of the members of the panel noted. I guess I'm out of time. So.
I said you had a minute 20 and you've used it.
Yeah.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Now, I can say we thank counsel for their arguments and briefs. The case will be deemed submitted and a written opinion will issue in due course. The last case on our docket, if I can find the docket.